Hi, this is Brian, and we are reading The Hill from Monday, April 6. The story, GOP's ICE funding, Gambit squeezes Republican agenda. Republicans plan to use the special budget reconciliation process to fund immigration enforcement without help from Democrats will complicate their hopes of using one of their few remaining shots at a GOP-only bill on priorities voting reform. Pentagon funding due to the Iran war, and cuts aimed at cracking down on fraud in federal programs. President Trump set a June 1 deadline for a reconciliation bill that funds Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, and Border Patrol as part of a two-step plan to end the Department of Homeland Security, or DHS, shutdown, giving up on coming to a compromise with Democrats demanding reforms as a condition of funding immigration enforcement. But with Republican leaders hoping to keep that bill as narrow as possible to meet the deadline, there is a growing consensus that those who had been advocating for a follow-up to last year's big, beautiful bill will actually need a third measure to achieve their priorities, a task that becomes exponentially more difficult the closer to election season Republicans get. Speed is the most important thing. Speed so that we have ICE and CBP fully funded, said Representative Randy Fine, Republican of Florida, a member of the House Freedom Caucus. So if you can do other things and be fast, I think that's great. There's a lot of things we would like to do, but given that we've already established there will be a third reconciliation bill, whether it's in 2.0 or 3.0, we'll still get it done. Senator Lindsey Graham, Republican of South Carolina, the chair of the Senate Budget Committee that will be key in crafting any reconciliation package, said at a Thursday event in South Carolina that he was now planning two more reconciliation bills, one done quick to address ICE and border funding, plus one in the fall to target fraud and incorporate voter reforms that he described as a down payment on the SAVE Act. Graham had initially been planning for a single reconciliation bill to include a boost to Pentagon funding due to the Iran war alongside ICE funding and voting reforms. If he is hoping to add the defense funding to a bill focused on ICE, that is sure to be met with demands from GOP fiscal hawks to offset that spending, further complicating the path to reopening DHS. The Pentagon has reportedly asked the White House to ask Congress for a $200 billion supplemental address, and the White House budget on Friday proposed that Congress pass around $350 billion in defense spending through the reconciliation process to increase access to critical munitions and further expand the defense industrial base. Republicans used budget reconciliation, a process that allows Republicans to circumvent a filibuster in the Senate as long as the legislation that's being considered meets certain budgetary requirements for the One Big Beautiful Bill Act, or OBBBA, of tax cuts and Trump's spending priorities last year. Because reconciliation can be used once per fiscal year, Speaker Mike Johnson, Republican of Louisiana, has long pitched taking one or two more bites at that apple before the end of this Congress. But even before the DHS funding fight, some Republicans were skeptical that they could get agreement to pass another bill of GOP priorities, given competing demands from fiscal hawks for spending cuts and from moderates to not pursue unpopular cuts in a midterm election year. Republicans will be able to afford to lose no more than one or two members on any party line vote in the House. House Budget Committee Chair Jody Arrington, Republican of Texas, whose panel will also be deeply involved in any reconciliation process, told reporters last month during a GOP retreat in Doral, Florida, that he doesn't see Republicans being able to move a reconciliation package past this spring. The closer we get to November, the more sensitive some of our members will be, he noted. With the risk of a reconciliation bill falling apart later in the year, there will be pressure from Republicans and other outside groups to pack as much as they can into a bill to fund ICE and Border Patrol. Any additional priority added to an ICE reconciliation bill, though, threatens to further delay reopening the Department of Homeland Security, or DHS, because it will involve more committees, more hearings, and more negotiations. Senate Majority Leader John Thune, Republican of South Dakota, acknowledged those difficulties on Thursday, noting that he wants to keep the second bill as narrow as possible. The other things implicate other committees and create jurisdictional challenges and germane issues on the floor, Thune told reporters. Our theory of the case behind all this was to keep that thing as narrow and focused as possible, and that maximizes, I think, the speed at which we can do it and the support for it. Plus, many House Republicans are demanding to see passage of a reconciliation bill to fund ICE and Border Patrol before they agree to pass a bipartisan Senate bill to fund the rest of DHS, a bill that Johnson had initially rejected as a joke before reverting to support it alongside Trump and Thune days later. There's no desire to pass the Senate Open Borders bill and then hope that we get a reconciliation bill that would close the border. They've got to come together, and we obviously already have one. We have the Senate Open Borders bill, and they've got to send over the one that will keep the border closed, Fine said. The story, Republican divisions, Trump's detachment stymie GOP efforts to reopen DHS. House and Senate Republicans scrambling to end the longest federal shutdown in U.S. history keep running into themselves. Within the House, Speaker Mike Johnson, Republican of Louisiana, and his leadership team haven't found a formula for containing their rebellious conservative wing. Between the chambers, Johnson and Senate Majority Leader John Thune, Republican of South Dakota, have been at odds over both substance and strategy. And from the White House, President Trump's mixed messages have thwarted progress at crucial moments when a breakthrough appeared at hand. The combination has complicated any path for a quick fix for reopening the Department of Homeland Security or DHS amid a historic shutdown that's frozen paychecks for tens of thousands of agency workers. It's also highlighted divisions within the Republican ranks and a deep distrust between the chambers, just as party leaders are fighting to showcase a united front heading into a tough midterm cycle in November. GOP leaders in both chambers have downplayed any evidence of internal strife. They're putting the blame for the DHS stalemate squarely on the shoulders of Democrats, who have refused to support any new funding for immigration enforcement unless it's accompanied by tougher rules governing the conduct of DHS's policing arms, U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, and Customs and Border Protection, or CBP. We have the Democrats who are holding the appropriations process hostage, Thune told reporters Thursday in the Capitol. Their anti-law enforcement, open borders, defund the police wing is the ascendant wing, and I think everybody is afraid of them. Yet Republican controls all levers of power in Washington, the House, Senate, and the White House, and they have potent tools at their disposal to fund the entirety of DHS, including the enforcement operations at the center of the partisan controversy, if they can rally their party behind a plan. So far, they've failed to do so. Indeed, Thune and Senate Republicans thought they'd threaded the needle last week with a two-step plan to divorce immigration enforcement funding from a broader DHS bill and move the pieces on separate tracks. The longer DHS bill passed through the upper chamber without a single voice of dissent, GOP senators thought Trump was on board. Hours later, however, the plan hit a brick wall in the House, where conservatives revolted with warnings that funding DHS without ICE and CBP would amount to caving to Democrats and would risk the country's national security. Johnson quickly sided with the conservatives, shelved the Senate bill, and moved instead on a short-term proposal to fund DHS in its entirety for 8 weeks. The Senate strategy, the Speaker said, was a joke. Trump piled on, criticizing the Senate's approach. But that was last week. On Wednesday, Trump announced a Republican deal that effectively adopted the Senate's strategy. Johnson, in a head-snapping reversal, endorsed the plan. And Thune said he expected the House to approve the Senate-passed DHS bill so that GOP leaders could get cracking on Phase 2, funding ICE and CBP, which Republicans want to move using a process known as reconciliation that cuts Democrats from the debate. We'll see ultimately what the House does with it, Thune said, but I think the fact that ICE and CBP are funded, because we pre-funded them last summer at least through the end of the fiscal year, through the One Big Beautiful Bill Act, and the fact that we're coming in behind it to top those accounts off, hopefully will be compelling enough for enough House members to support funding the other agencies in the department. Shortly after Thune spoke, the House opened up for a short pro forma session, a routine event during long breaks like the current spring recess, providing GOP leaders an opportunity to move the Senate DHS bill immediately by unanimous consent. They declined the chance. Instead, Johnson staged a conference-wide call with House Republicans later in the morning, where some of those conservatives fumed over Johnson's decision to endorse the Senate's two-step approach. Some GOP lawmakers simply don't trust Senate Republicans to make good on promises to move the ICE funds after a DHS package becomes law. They're leveraging their votes to demand that the enforcement piece go first. There's no desire to pass the Senate Open Borders bill and then hope that we get a reconciliation bill that would close the border. They've got to come together, said Representative Randy Fine, Republican of Florida. We obviously already have one. We have the Senate Open Borders bill, he continued. Now they've got to send over the one that will keep the border closed. The demand puts Johnson in a pickle. He could ignore the conservative uproar and try to pass the Senate bill with the help of Democrats who have already signaled their support, but such a move would infuriate his right flank, and it might risk an internal challenge to his gavel. Alternatively, Johnson could embrace the change in sequencing the conservatives are demanding and move the ICE piece first, but that would delay the end of the shutdown for weeks, if not months, leaving Republicans open to charges that their incompetence is prolonging the DHS impasse, along with the disruptions and pay freezes that have accompanied it. Thune, for one, is aware of the pressures Johnson is facing, and with a hint of frustration, he suggested the conservative demands are politically impossible. The thing that some people want to do, we can't do, Thune said. You've got to figure out what's in the realm of the possible. Trump, through it all, hasn't helped to grease the skids. At crucial moments of the debate, he declined to weigh in publicly, a silence that first gave Senate Republicans the impression he supported Thune's plan and then provided Johnson initially with the political space to reject it. When Trump did comment, the messages were contradictory. Last week, he criticized any plan to fund DHS without ICE. On Wednesday, he endorsed that very thing. The president has also acted unilaterally to pay Transportation Security Administration employees, and more recently, he announced a plan to ensure that all DHS employees receive paychecks during the shutdown, which has taken enormous pressure off of Congress to do anything at all. Even Trump's most recent missive, the endorsement of moving ICE and CBP funding separately through reconciliation, makes no mention of the Senate-passed DHS bill or how he wants House lawmakers to approach it. That void has freed House conservatives to bash the Senate's preferred sequencing and demand that the immigration enforcement piece precede the larger DHS bill. How House GOP leaders respond remains unclear. The House isn't scheduled to return to Washington until the week of April 13. Meanwhile, Thune is making clear that he thinks the Senate's plan is the quickest path to a resolution. There are just limited options, Thune said, and my question for everybody who doesn't like what we did is give me a better idea, give me a better option. The story, Hassan Piker, controversy heats up Michigan's Senate primary for Democrats. Michigan Senate candidate Abdul El Sayed's plans to rally in the state this week with controversial live streamer Hassan Piker is roiling the Democratic primary, with other candidates blasting the decision to invite him on the campaign trail. El Sayed, the former Wayne County Health Director, backed by progressive Senator Bernie Sanders, independent of Vermont, was the runner-up to Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer, Democrat, in the 2018 Democratic gubernatorial primary. He's earned significant progressive backing, but his decision to invite Piker to rally with him on Tuesday at the University of Michigan and Michigan State University has raised the hackles of his Democratic rivals while upping concerns for his party that if he wins the primary, he could make it easier for Republicans to take back the seat. Representative Haley Stevens, Democrat of Michigan, one of El Sayed's opponents, told Jewish Insider that Piker is the exact opposite of someone I'd be campaigning with. State Senator Mallory McMorrow compared Piker to far-right influencer Nick Fuentes, an avowed anti-Semite. The center-left think tank Third Way's Matt Bennett took to the social platform X to call El Sayed a disgrace to the Democratic primary, a party. Piker has millions of followers on YouTube, Instagram, and X, and a large progressive following that could boost El Sayed. The controversy that follows him derives in part from remarks he made about the October 7, 2023 attack by Hamas on Israel, in which more than 1,200 people were killed. He said it was a direct consequence of Israel and U.S. government actions, and that if rapes happened as part of the Hamas campaign, it doesn't change the dynamic for me. Piker has pushed back at accusations of anti-Semitism, saying his criticisms have been focused on the U.S. and Israeli governments. Those criticisms could resonate with many voters inside Michigan, both among young progressives and Michigan's large Muslim community. El Sayed has stood his ground amid the backlash to Piker's visit, arguing that he's meeting voters where they are and pointing out that Piker was allowed to stream from the Democratic National Convention back in 2024. Other candidates can spend their time policing where conversations happen and who gets to be a part of them if they want. Abdul is focused on showing up everywhere, a spokesperson for the campaign told The Hill in an email. Michigan Democratic strategist Adrian Hemond suggested the drama around Piker could give McMorrow more room to separate herself from El Sayed as they both woo progressives. McMorrow, seen as a rising star in the Democratic Party, has pitched herself as part of a new generation of Democratic leaders and has openly called for Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer, Democrat of New York, to step down from leadership. Progressive Senator Elizabeth Warren, Democrat of Massachusetts, endorsed McMorrow over El Sayed last month, a sign that she's fighting with El Sayed for the party's progressive wing. Sparse polling signals a close Democratic primary race, with all three candidates idling at less than 30% support and a significant portion of voters still undecided. Those undecideds, they could be folks who are trying to decide between Stevens and one of those other two, but they could also be more progressives who are trying to decide between McMorrow and El Sayed. We just don't know what that is from the polling that we've got, said David Duilio, a political science professor at Michigan's Oakland University. So I think we could be at an inflection point with this Piker visit just because it's gotten so much attention and it is controversial. Stevens, who has represented Michigan's 11th congressional district since 2019, entered the race as the establishment favorite, a moderate with the benefit of high name ID as a sitting member of Congress. She is aligned with the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee and seen as a strong pro-Israel voice in the House. The three candidates are fighting to succeed the retiring Senator Gary Peters, Democrat of Michigan. The winner of the August primary is expected to take on former Representative Mike Rogers, Republican of Michigan, who's on track to win the GOP nod for the second cycle in a row after narrowly losing a 2024 bid. The Michigan seat, one of just a handful of 2026 Senate toss-ups, could be make or break for either party in November as Democrats fight an uphill battle to win back the Senate majority. In the wide-open race, the news around El Sayed's stops with Piker are riling some people up, Duilio said. It's making headlines here and elsewhere. We start to see the factions within the Democratic Party on display. Michigan represents presents a major opening for Republicans just 2 years after Rogers came within a point of flipping former Senator Debbie Stabenow's Democrat of Michigan seat, losing to then-Representative Alyssa Slotkin, Democrat of Michigan, in the 2024 election as President Trump flipped the swing state by a little more than a point in the presidential race. Last year's decision by Peters, who led the Democrat Senate campaign arm, to retire after more than a decade in the Senate, set off a scramble in the Great Lakes state politics. The nonpartisan election handicapper Cook Political Report rates the 2026 Michigan Senate race as one of just four toss-ups among the 35 upper chamber seats up for grabs in November. It's one of just three toss-ups in ratings from Sabato's crystal ball. For the Senate, it is the best pickup opportunity that we have in the country, said Jason Cable Rowe, a former executive director of the Michigan Republican Party. There's not a lot of pickup opportunities, so if some of our incumbents find themselves at risk, the seat becomes even more important. Despite Trump's recent win at the top of the ticket, Republicans have struggled for more than 30 years to win a Senate seat in the purple state, but Rogers, recruited by the National Republican Senatorial Committee, gave the party new hopes of a potential flip. Boasting an endorsement from Trump, Rogers faces no serious challenger in the Republican primary as he takes another shot at the Senate, giving him room to relax while Democrats jostle through their contentious primary. Rogers is in the enviable position of holding their coats while they fight it out, Rowe said. Some polls suggest Rogers would see his best chance of winning if El Sayed won the Democratic primary. In the most recent independent polling on a hypothetical general election, a late January survey from Emerson College Polling, McMorrow beats Rogers by 3 points and Stevens bested the Republican by 4 points. Voters were tied in a test between El Sayed and Rogers. Heman argued that Democrats are not as stressed as they should be about November and that Rogers is being somewhat underestimated by Democrats in Michigan after coming so close to the Senate in 2024. Still, he noted that Trump won't be on the ticket this time as Democrats revel in a string of off-year and special election wins across the country. Rogers is probably as good as they could have hoped for a candidate this time around, but it's a very, very tough environment for Republicans, Heman said. The story, FCC eyes changes to live sports broadcast rules amid fan frustration. The Federal Communications Commission, or FCC, is opening the door to a rewrite of its rules for local blackout restrictions on live sports, a move that could be the first step in a potential shakeup of the broadcasting landscape for pro leagues and their media partners. The FCC announced in February that it is seeking public comment on consumer experience with live sports viewing, noting the rising cost of subscription services and pointing out what it called a fragmented modern media landscape. The department's move comes as polls and social media feedback consistently show fans are increasingly annoyed with the cost and hassle of paywalled subscription services required to view games. Lawmakers on Capitol Hill, meanwhile, are suggesting Congress do more to curb the leverage top leagues have long held over when making deals on media rights. The thing that's getting lost in some of this discussion is the broader economics of sports, one media consultant specializing in streaming told The Hill this week. Leagues are pretty clearly not interested in doing what's best for fans, and why would they be when people continue to pay to see games on all of these services? Today it is more expensive than ever to watch live sports events, particularly marquee events like the NFL playoffs or the NCAA March Madness tournament. Major streamers like YouTube TV and Roku have largely replaced traditional cable bundles, while more media companies like Disney, Paramount, and Comcast have launched direct-to-consumer streaming services, largely with pro and college sports coverage in mind. No league is more profitable for major media conglomerates than the NFL, which raked in more than $110 billion with its most recent broadcast rights deal. Consumers who wished to watch every single NFL game last season had to pay upwards of $1,000 and subscribe to 10 different services to do so, according to estimates by the FCC. The department bemoaned the current streaming landscape, arguing in its public notice seeking comment that sports remains inherently local, despite the increasingly national nature and reach of both professional and college games. It added, "We believe it is important for us to evaluate the sports media landscape and understand how changes have impacted consumers and broadcasters." Some of the NFL's longtime partners would like to see the FCC's rules stay the way they are. Fox Corporation, in a filing with the FCC reviewed by The Hill, warned that there could be a dramatic impact on both consumers and local journalism if streaming became the default means by which Americans watch live sports. In a world where big tech acquires more and more broadcast sports rights, often as a loss leader to support other massive vertically integrated businesses that primarily profit off of the personal consumption data of its customers, fans across the country could be paywalled out of the fall classic, Thanksgiving football, or Team USA's victories in the Olympics or the World Cup, the Rupert Murdoch-owned company said. Experts and observers within the sports media business point to the NFL's deal-making as key to what the future of all sports broadcasting looks like. The downstream impact of the NFL's prominence is felt by other leagues competing for a smaller viewership pot. These people say, "Sports are one of the last things people are watching live. People still care and they want to watch these games," said Olivia Stomsky, director of Syracuse University's Newhouse Sports Media Center. "I can't help but think of the older sports fan who is maybe retired and say the Mets game is the highlight of their day or their week, and now they can't find it or pay for another platform they maybe can't afford. Fans of teams and leagues like the MLB and NHL have for years relied on regional sports networks via cable providers to watch games, but as more consumers cut cable each year, these networks find themselves under increasing pressure to retain audience." The FCC has no jurisdiction over major tech platforms like Amazon, Netflix, or Apple, all of which have poured billions into live sports streaming in recent years. The FCC seeking public comment on local blackout restrictions is widely seen as a precursor to potential reform of the Sports Broadcasting Act of 1961. The act, passed by Congress after a boom in popularity across the NFL and the advent of color television, granted professional football teams the ability to collectively license the sponsored telecasts of their games to national broadcast networks. Some lawmakers, like Senator Mike Lee, Republican of Utah, argue the SBA is outdated and needs a revamp with streaming in mind. The modern distribution environment differs substantially from the conditions that precipitated this exemption, Lee wrote in a letter to the Department of Justice and the Federal Trade Commission. To the extent collectively licensed game packages are placed behind subscription paywalls, these arrangements may no longer align with the statutory concept of sponsored telecasting or the consumer access rationale underlying the antitrust exemption. Others say an effort on Capitol Hill to repeal the SBA, as well as changes to the FCC's current blackout restrictions, could cause more chaos for fans to navigate. "There are real problems with extending the SBA to streaming services," said Kelly Lerner, a prominent antitrust attorney. "If Congress is going to go that direction, you can't just invalidate it with no solution, or we're going to end up worse off than we are now, which is already pretty bad." Extra points: body camera footage from Tiger Woods' DUI arrest last week shows the star golfer taking a call from President Trump and asking police to retrieve the putter he won more than 10 majors with from the trunk of his flipped-over vehicle. At one point during the video, one of the deputies asked Woods if he will play the Masters this year, to which Woods replied, "Depends on y'all." Woods announced this week he was stepping back from golf to seek treatment, while Trump has praised Grand Slam winner, saying he'll be fine. Television ratings for March Madness were through the roof this spring. Last month's men's tournament earned the largest audience it has seen since the early 1990s and topped out during the thrilling UConn versus Duke game in Washington, D.C., which garnered a whopping 18 million viewers at its highest point. A circuit court judge ruled against University of Virginia quarterback Chandler Morris as he sought a preliminary injunction for a seventh season of eligibility. The Associated Press reported the NCAA said it was pleased with the decision in a statement, vowing to defend against attempts to rob high school students across the nation of an opportunity to compete in college. Jocks on the Hill, Officer Joey Kapliger, a 7-year veteran of Capitol Police Department, answered some sports questions for The Hill. Favorite team, all-time Ohio State football, I will never miss a game. I was born up there, so that's easy. Favorite sport, baseball up until I got into middle school and high school and started track and field, but until then, yeah, definitely baseball. Who was an athlete you looked up to growing up? David Ortiz. I was a Red Sox fan and started playing Little League just before their 2004 run. So once that happened, I don't know, I became a Red Sox fan and he was at the heart of it for sure. Is there a team you hate? Michigan for sure, and the Yankees. Those are definitely the top two out of any. There has been a lot of talk about policing balls and strikes in Major League Baseball and a push to integrate ABS or Automated Ball Strike Challenge System, allowing players to appeal home plate umpire calls on balls and strikes and umpiring. Some former umpires are calling foul. The Athletics' Sam Bloom quotes legendary umpire Joe West ripping the system, saying, "My problem is that they haven't proven it's as accurate as they say it is." It's Masters Monday, and there has been a lot of chatter about fashion brand Malbon's aggressive moves into the golf industry. Australian Jason Day, one of the company's top ambassadors, is turning heads with his planned outfits at Augusta National this week, a move Sports Illustrated argues pushes the limits of what is acceptable attire on the tee, box, and green. The Ringer's Michael Lee has a great profile of Kevin Durant and comes with a subhead that really says it all. Don't let Twitter fingers obscure the hands of maybe the greatest scorer ever. As KD approaches MJ, he's still chasing perfection, and the legend he calls the blueprint of this whole thing. The story, Chris Murphy on Trump's Iran threat, a clear war crime. Senator Chris Murphy, Democrat of Connecticut, on Sunday derided President Trump's latest threats to Iran as war crimes if committed. Trump is calling reporters today to tell them he is going to commit mass war crimes next week. Murphy wrote on the social platform X, GOP leaders need to stop him. Never mind that blowing up bridges and power plants and killing innocent Iranians won't reopen the strait. It's also a clear war crime. Early Sunday morning, the president wrote on his Truth Social platform, Tuesday will be power plant day and bridge day, all wrapped up in one. In Iran, there will be nothing like it. Open the effing strait, you crazy bastards, or you'll be living in hell. Just watch. Praise be to Allah. Trump reiterated his threats in multiple interviews on Today. As Iran restricting shipping through the Strait of Hormuz continues to push energy prices up, including in the U.S., where the average price of a gallon of regular gas hit $4.11 on Sunday, according to AAA. Murphy further criticized Trump's threats against Iranian infrastructure targets, writing on X that he isn't even pretending to choose military targets and is willing to kill tens of thousands of civilians in order to cause a national panic. Since the U.S. and Israel launched airstrikes against Iran on February 28, more than 1,600 civilians in the Middle Eastern country, including at least 244 children, have been killed as of Sunday, according to U.S.-based human rights activist news agency. He says he's going to destroy all Iranian bridges and power plants, Murphy added, referring to the president. Okay, he's probably lying, but even blowing up a fraction will kill thousands of innocent people who work in those power plants and travel on the nation's roads. That's also a war crime. And for what? To force Iran to open the Strait of Hormuz, which was open before Trump started bombing Iran? This is pure insanity, the Connecticut Democrat continued. It won't work. It will just permanently stain America. GOP leaders should call Congress back into session this week to end this war. Other Democratic lawmakers sharply criticized Trump's threats against Iran, throughout Sunday. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer, Democrat of New York, wrote on X that as millions of Americans head off to church and celebrate with friends and family for Easter, Trump is ranting like an unhinged madman online. He's threatening possible war crimes and alienating allies. Schumer added, "This is who he is, but this is not who we are. Our country deserves so much better." House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries, Democrat of New York, also wrote on X that Trump's rhetoric is disgusting and unhinged. "Something's really wrong with this guy. Thank you for your attention to this matter," Jeffries added, invoking the president's signature tagline. Progressive Senator Bernie Sanders, independent of Vermont, wrote on X, 1 month after starting the war in Iran, "This is the statement of the President of the United States on Easter Sunday, sharing a screenshot of the president's Truth Social post. These are the ravings of a dangerous and mentally unbalanced individual." Sanders continued, "Congress has got to act now, end this war." The story, Iran says U.S. aircraft destroyed during recovery mission for missing service member. An Iranian news outlet on Sunday reported that multiple U.S. aircraft were destroyed during the mission to rescue a stranded American service member in Iran. The Iranian Fars news agency, which is close to the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, reported that two C-130 aircraft and two UH-60 Black Hawk helicopters were destroyed during the mission. Multiple outlets, including CNN, Reuters, and the Wall Street Journal, also shared images of destroyed aircraft that Iranian state media released. CNN geolocated the footage to the southern Isfahan province in Iran. The Hill has reached out to U.S. Central Command, or CENTCOM, which oversees the military operations in the region, for comment. At just past midnight EDT on Sunday, President Trump wrote on his Truth Social platform that U.S. forces rescued a missing service member from Iran after his F-15 Strike Eagle fighter jet was shot down over the Middle Eastern country. "My fellow Americans, over the past several hours, the United States military pulled off one of the most daring search and rescue operations in U.S. history for one of our incredible crew member officers, who also happens to be a highly respected colonel, and who I am thrilled to let you know is now safe and sound," the president said. "This brave warrior was behind enemy lines in the treacherous mountains of Iran, being hunted down by our enemies, who were getting closer and closer by the hour, but was never truly alone because his commander-in-chief, Secretary of War, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and fellow warfighters were monitoring his location 24 hours a day and diligently planning for his rescue," Trump added. Iranian forces shot down the fighter jet earlier this week, with one crew member rescued by U.S. forces before the weekend. The incident marked the first known instance of a U.S. plane being downed inside Iranian airspace since the conflict began on February 28. A Black Hawk helicopter and a second search and rescue helicopter were struck by Iranian fire on Friday while carrying out a rescue mission for the crew, a source familiar with the matter, speaking on condition of anonymity to share operational details, told The Hill. CENTCOM confirmed on social media that U.S. forces rescued the second service member on Saturday. "This type of raid is seldom attempted because of the danger to man and equipment," the president wrote Sunday in a separate Truth Social post, noting that the service member was seriously wounded. "It just doesn't happen. The second raid came after the first one, where we rescued the pilot in broad daylight, also unusual, spending 7 hours over Iran. An amazing show of bravery and talent by all." The story, former Trump advisor on president's latest Iran threat, not going to get a deal. Brent McGurk, who served under President Trump during his first term, warned that the president's latest threats against Iran will not bring Tehran to the table to negotiate on opening the Strait of Hormuz. "This is an escalate to try to get a deal that's not going to get a deal," McGurk, who also served in national security roles under former Presidents Biden, Obama, and Bush, told CNN's Jake Tapper on State of the Union, later noting that the president is just kind of shifting objectives in terms of what exactly we're trying to achieve here. Earlier Sunday, Trump threatened to target Iranian civilian infrastructure in a profanity-filled Truth Social post ahead of a self-imposed Monday deadline to reopen the Strait of Hormuz. Tuesday will be a power plant day and bridge day, all wrapped up in one, Iran. In Iran, there will be nothing like it. Open the effing strait, you crazy bastards, or you'll be living in hell. Just watch. Praise be to Allah, President Donald J. Trump. Trump wrote on social media. The vital waterway, which has been effectively closed since the U.S. and Israel launched strikes on Iran in late February, has become a key issue as global oil prices spike. U.S. allies have expressed frustration with the war in Iran, particularly about what they view as a lack of preparation to keep the strait open. Trump, in a Wednesday address to the nation, said that the strait would reopen when the conflict ends. But Trump on Sunday morning told Fox News' Trey Yingst that he believes the U.S. will be able to hammer out a deal to reopen the vital shipping route by Monday. The president told Fox that Tehran and Washington were engaged in talks Sunday. McGurk, who has been critical of Trump and the conflict, said that these negotiations are particularly difficult given their secretive nature. I mean, with diplomacy with Iran, and it's a lot of its secret back channel because they publicly posture, and the way we publicly posture makes it very hard to actually, I think, achieve what he's trying to achieve, McGurk told Tapper, adding that for this to conclude with Iran in control of the Strait of Hormuz, Jake, I think that would be a very bad outcome. The story, Eulogy for the CIA Factbook, the free standard for world facts, long an educational staple, is gone. If you attended school any time after the Nixon administration, then you likely beheld at some point the CIA World Factbook, a map and reference manual of planet Earth and its inhabitants, upon which nearly everyone could agree. Maybe you read parts of it from a floppy disk or a CD-ROM for that social studies project due tomorrow, or scanned its list of countries for Latvia, because that is the country you are representing next week in Model UN Even Better. You wandered the Earth in your imagination as you held the physical factbook in your own hands, unfolding its maps and understanding, perhaps for the first time, that the thumbs-up gesture your friends flash each other is considered an obscene insult in parts of the Middle East, Europe, and Argentina. Who knew? The factbook and its readers did for more than six decades. Its authors, some of the world's best intelligence gatherers, who contributed thousands of their own photos, kept the curated database updated and online for public use at no charge. The reasons stated were geopolitical and philosophical, but since we are talking about facts, it is also true that the factbook went public in 1975 with lofty statements of purpose at a time when Congress was revealing abuses by U.S. intelligence agencies, including the CIA. We share these facts with the people of all nations in the belief that knowledge of truth underpins the functioning of free societies, the CIA itself explained in its pages. The spy agency is not sharing them anymore. On February 4, the Trump administration abruptly shuttered this widely accepted account of humanity and its flags, nations, customs, militaries, and borders. The CIA framed the move as one of progress for an agency whose core mission has changed. The great wave of grief rose from factbook fans. Many said they mourned an America that valued knowledge for its own sake. Some saw darker forces at work under a president whose administration has promoted, in times of war and peace, alternative facts. Stay curious, the CIA advised in its fond farewell to the factbook. And it might have added, good luck figuring out what's true from the wild and frequently inaccurate world of the internet and artificial intelligence. Decades before Google became an everyday verb, there was the factbook. Its origin story is rooted in the Japanese surprise attack on Pearl Harbor in 1941, a U.S. intelligence failure that inspired a more coordinated approach to gathering and organizing information on America's enemies. The Joint Army-Navy Intelligence Studies were born, the country's first interdepartmental basic intelligence program, but by 1946, and national security experts agreed that the conduct of peace involves all countries, all human activities, not just the enemy and his war production, in the words of one George S. Petit. The job of gathering basic intelligence on other countries was assigned to the newly minted CIA in 1947, according to the agency's website. The Cold War exposed the ongoing need for a one-stop source of basic intelligence and an opportunity for what in 1971 became the Unclassified Factbook. It was released to the public 4 years later. In addition to becoming useful to students, it held geopolitical influence. The Factbook showed off American intelligence capabilities to the former Soviet Union and other enemies. Being included in it could confer legitimacy upon a nation or an opposition party, and it was ironic that an agency founded on the need to know and keep secrets was sharing so much data called basic intelligence with the public. The Factbook also likely served as a boost to the CIA's public image and put distance between it and other intelligence agencies, tarnished by congressional investigations. In 1975, U.S. Senator Frank Church, Democrat of Idaho, convened a panel that held more than 100 public hearings, many televised, of the most significant oversight of the intelligence agencies since World War II. In 1976, the Church Committee reported widespread abuse by the CIA, IRS, the National Security Agency, and FBI, including the revelation of the CIA's family jewels. That was an internal account of illegal CIA activities, such as spying on American activists and an assassination plot against Cuba's Fidel Castro. Also in 1975, what would become the CIA World Factbook went public, ascending as a reliable research tool, often recommended in class projects. There was never confirmation that the bad press inspired the wide release of the Factbook, but doing so around the same time fit the CIA's need to rehab its brand. In 1981, the CIA renamed the publication the World Factbook, and in 1997, it leapt online. The CIA has described it as representing a tremendous culmination of efforts from some of our country's brightest analytic minds. The jolt of its Trump-era demise. News of the Factbook's end shocked more than just U.S. students and researchers. It was picked up by news outlets abroad. The story shot across social media, with Reddit users pointing each other to archived Factbooks and racing to set up and identify other sources of unbiased information that might suffice. Isabel Altamirano, chemistry librarian assistant professor at Auburn University in Alabama, said the information is still out there, but it'll be harder to find. University libraries, for example, offer similar resources to students who get access through their tuition. It was so easy because it was all in one place, she said in an interview, noting that on February 4, when she saw the news, she rushed to delete the Factbook from a list of resources for her students in a business communications class. Fundamentally, one analyst said, a Factbook assembled by a government agency with secret agendas and shadowy methods might never have been unbiased in the first place. The compilers aren't, nor can they be expected to be neutral, said Benoit Kempmark, a professor of global urban and social studies at Royal Melbourne Institute of Technology in Australia. Mourning its loss, he wrote in an email, would be misplaced. The Factbook, he added, might be better saved as a historical document. Its last publication on February 4 is already outdated, according to an archived version. Under Iran, the country's head of government is still listed as supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. Khamenei was reportedly killed March 1 in U.S. and Israeli strikes, and the world changed once again, this time without the Factbook to note it. The story is The Hill's Morning Report. Trump dials up Iran rhetoric with expletive-filled deadline threat. In today's issue, Iran threat reissued with F-bomb. Trump denies cabinet overhaul. History behind the mask ban debate. Trump endorses in California governor race. President Trump amplified his deadline for Iran to reopen the Strait of Hormuz, declaring in a profanity-laced social media post over the weekend that the U.S. will escalate attacks on Iran's civilian infrastructure if no agreement is reached by Tuesday. Tuesday will be Power Plant Day and Bridge Day, all wrapped up in one. In Iran, there will be nothing like it. Open the effing straight, you crazy bastards, or you'll be living in hell. Just watch. Praise be to Allah, Trump said in a Truth Social post on Sunday. The threat drew warnings of potential war crimes from Democrats and military experts. Trump is calling reporters today to tell them he is going to commit mass war crimes next week. GOP leaders need to stop him, Senator Chris Murphy, Democrat of Connecticut, said in a thread on the social platform X, referring to Trump's remark to ABC News' Rachel Scott that the U.S. would be blowing up the whole country if Iran remains defiant. Never mind that blowing up bridges and power plants and killing innocent Iranians won't reopen the strait. It's also a clear war crime, Murphy added. Both Reuters and Axios reported that talks on a temporary ceasefire ramped up over the weekend, but that Tehran was refusing demands to reopen the strait as part of a short-term deal. The president has twice pushed back a deadline for Iran to reopen the strait, which has been effectively closed since the war began more than 5 weeks ago, expressing some optimism that Iran was interested in making a deal. But Iranian officials have publicly pushed back on the president's claims, and Trump threatened to send Iran back to the Stone Ages during a primetime speech last week, and Trump repeatedly doubled down on his delayed deadline this weekend. Remember when I gave Iran 10 days to make a deal or open up the Hormuz Strait? Time is running out. 48 hours before all hell will rain down on them, he said in a Truth Social post on Saturday. He cryptically posted Tuesday 8 p.m. Eastern Time later on Sunday, but didn't make clear exactly what the time refers to. Trump is holding a press briefing with military leaders today at 1 p.m. at the White House, where additional updates on the situation are expected. If Trump were to follow through on his threat, it would mark a significant escalation in the war, which Trump said in his Wednesday address to the U.S. would conclude in the next 2 or 3 weeks. Trump told The Hill's Julia Manchester and Mallory Wilson on a phone interview Sunday that he wouldn't rule out sending in ground troops if Tehran doesn't make a deal. Normal people would make a deal. Smart people would make a deal. He said if they were smart, they would make a deal. Trump told Scott of ABC News that the conflict should be over in days, not weeks. Trump has reportedly been weighing deploying ground troops to seize Karg Island, an area inside the Persian Gulf key to Iran's oil exports, or taking Iran's enriched uranium, believed to be buried in a bombed-out nuclear facility. But any ground incursion would potentially expose U.S. forces to casualties and could extend the war even further. Iran shot down a U.S. Air Force fighter jet on Friday, marking the first time it has downed an American fighter jet since the war began. The two pilots of the F-15 Strike Eagle were both rescued, including one who had been missing for a day. We have rescued the seriously wounded and really brave F-15 crew member officer from deep inside the mountains of Iran, Trump wrote Sunday on Truth Social. Polls show most Americans oppose his handling of the conflict, and oil and gas prices have soared, adding pressure on the president. The average national cost of gas surpassed $4.10 per gallon over the weekend, according to AAA. The Hill's Sarah Fortinsky reports an international jet fuel shortage is also driving up airfares and causing thousands of flight cancellations, an effect that analysts warn could get worse in the coming weeks. But the president has sought to assure the country that the economic impacts of the war will be short-lived and prices will quickly come down once the operation ends. Three things to note today. Multiple U.S. aircraft were destroyed in the mission to rescue the stranded U.S. pilot, according to the Iranian Fars news agency. Other outlets have shared images of destroyed aircraft that Iranian state media released. Pope Leo XIV, the first U.S.-born pope, called for peace to solve global conflicts during his first Easter Mass as Pontiff Sunday. His predecessor, Pope Francis, died the day after Easter last year. The crew of the Artemis II mission will set a new record for the farthest distance traveled from Earth today, surpassing a mark set by Apollo 13. It will happen during a flyby of the moon before crew members begin their trip back home. Leading the day, cabinet shakeup. Trump pushed back Sunday on reports of additional cabinet swaps coming after his ousting of former Attorney General Pam Bondi. Trump told the Hill that the country is on the right track and other changes aren't coming. Speculation has swirled in the days since Bondi was fired that other cabinet members may be next. Bondi was the second member of Trump's second-term cabinet to leave their role during the administration, coming just weeks after the firing of former Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem. Reports have raised questions about the future of several cabinet members, including FBI Director Kash Patel, Director of National Intelligence Tulsi Gabbard, Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick, and Labor Secretary Lori Chavez de Remer. But the White House and Trump's allies have denied that additional changes are forthcoming. Secretaries Chavez de Remer and Lutnick are both doing a great job standing up for American workers, and they continue to have President Trump's full support, White House spokesperson Taylor Rogers said in a statement. POTUS has total confidence in Gabbard, and any insinuation otherwise is totally fake news, White House Communications Director Stephen Chung said in a statement on X. Still, this wouldn't be the first time the administration has praised a cabinet member before their exit. Trump said Bondi was doing a good job in response to a report of her impending departure before he ultimately fired her, though the White House didn't issue a full-blown denial, as it has with some of the other cabinet members currently being talked about. Funding push. House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries, Democrat of New York, called on Speaker Mike Johnson, Republican of Louisiana, to bring the lower chamber back from recess early to reopen the Department of Homeland Security. Jeffries said Sunday on ABC's This Week that Johnson should bring the House back to stop creating chaos at airports all across the country and forcing employees to continue working without pay. The House convened in a pro forma session last week, but didn't take action on the bill. The chamber isn't currently set to return from its Easter recess until next week, after Trump came out in favor of a two-step process to fund most of DHS through the normal appropriations reconciliation. The Senate passed a bill to fund all DHS agencies except for U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, and Border Patrol. It now awaits action in the House. All DHS workers are set to get relief after weeks of no pay, as Trump formally ordered the department on Friday to pay its employees, following up on an order to pay Transportation Security Administration, or TSA, employees. But that's a temporary solution for the funding gap. Even with support from Johnson and other members of the House GOP leadership, getting the funding plan through the House may not be easy, with members of the staunchly conservative House Freedom Caucus slamming it for not including funding for immigration enforcement. And finally, Savannah Guthrie is set to return as co-host NBC's Today Show on Monday, more than 2 months after the disappearance of her mother. Authorities have still not located Nancy Guthrie, who went missing from her home in Tucson, Arizona on February 1. Officials believe she was taken against her will, but they have no substantial leads in the case despite thousands of tips and multiple purported ransom notes reviewed. NBC announced late last month that Savannah Guthrie would return to her role. It's hard to imagine doing it because it's such a place of joy and lightness, and I can't come back and try to be something that I'm not, she told her former co-host Hoda Kotb on March 27. But I can't not come back because it's my family. I think it's part of my purpose right now.